high school, I've been attempting to use it to create the illusion that I actually have a normal chin. I regularly grew a goatee in college. It wasn't a full goatee, because there were serious connectivity issues between my mustache and beard. It was more of an overgrown soul patch. It added some dimension to my face, but left quite a bit exposed. Shortly after college, my beard began to fill in, allowing me to see the potential to use my facial hair to accomplish something I had been hoping to do for years, establish a jawline. Thus, my chin strap phase began. Although I love horses and agree that much of modern technology is a vice, I definitely was not trying to apply for a position on an Amish farm. I would have grown a full beard were it not for the persisting mustache beard gap. The beauty low light of my life occurred during the years where my hair of defeat coincided with my chin strap, which happens to be the precise time we were getting our start on YouTube. I would like to take this opportunity to officially apologize for the chin strap. While I feel that extenuating, as well as genetic, circumstances left me with little choice, there had to be a better way. I was afraid that my full beard would be too patchy, and in my defense, the weak hipster beard look wasn't a thing in 2006. Thankfully, around the time I was turning 30, my beard was beginning to experience its full potential, and I was finally able to absorb the hideous chin strap into a fully formed beard. I promise it won't happen again. Thanks for understanding.
Taming the unibrow. I, too, had a genetic facial hair hurdle to clear. My Nana's branch of the family tree, the Buchanans, all suffered from persistent gapless brow syndrome, a.k.a. the unibrow. Some were more pronounced than others. Great-granny Cheryl probably endured the occasional pluck back in her dating days, but Uncle James sported a thick shelf of forehead forestation that stretched uninterrupted from temple to temple. During the beginning of my freshman year of high school, I was looking in the mirror and realized it was happening to me. A hair bridge was forming between my otherwise island-like eyebrows. I tried to tell them they'd be happier apart, but they couldn't be reasoned with because they were hair. "This can't be happening," I worried. "It's my freshman year. Facial things like this feel like they determine the fate of the rest of your life. I had to do something." The next day, I showed up to class with a space between my eyebrows exactly the width of a Gillette sensor razor. I'd altered the trajectory of my high school career with one single swoop. It was so easy, and so wide. I clear-cut the forest, but I really only needed to make a nature trail. In homeroom, Rhett asked, "What did you do?" I said, "I took care of it." He said, "It's gonna grow back thicker, man. Don't you know you got a pluck?" He must have been reading Cosmo or something. That afternoon, Rhett's dad was driving us home. I remember Rhett saying, "Dad, Link shaved his eyebrows with a razor. Tell him they're going to grow back thicker. Tell him he's got a pluck." It was a little embarrassing to get grooming advice from my friend's dad, but I did switch to plucking from there on out. And for some reason, I didn't want to tell my mom I was plucking my eyebrows, so I would sneak in her bathroom and borrow her tweezers while she was watching Entertainment Tonight. Today, I'm a proud plucker. But I do shave a patch of hair on each of my shoulders that's exactly the width of a Gillette sensor razor.
Chapter 4.
Build a time capsule.
In first grade, we learned about time capsules from Miss Locklear. We were immediately fascinated by the idea that we could send important messages to the deep future simply by choosing a collection of items to be preserved and discovered later. However, just learning about time capsules wasn't enough. We wanted to make our own.
Picking the right container was key. It had to be the kind of enclosure that could safely hold our precious cargo for generations. But more important, it had to be something two first graders could acquire. Ultimately, we landed on a cardboard paper towel tube sealed at both ends with duct tape. We were six.
Then came the contents, the real heart of our message. We had to choose these objects carefully. We determined it would be best to include one item from each of us, as well as one collective offering.
I offered up a G.I. Joe figure. Doc, to be exact. I thought that if anyone could survive years underground in a duct tape-sealed cardboard tube, it was a doctor. And to be honest, Doc was my most expendable G.I. Joe figure. I never saw much need for a medic on my pretend battlefield since there was never any actual blood.
I figured that the people of the future would want to know how the people of the past ate. Plus, I was, as usual, thinking about food. I reasoned that a pack of crackers, specifically the bright orange cheese crackers, with peanut butter sandwiched between them, commonly called nabs throughout the South, were a great representative foodstuff of our era. I had never seen a pack of nabs go bad, no matter how long my dad left one in the glove compartment of his Caprice Classic. Also, nabs were the only food I had on hand that could comfortably fit into a paper towel tube.
Finally, we determined that our time capsule should accommodate the unlikely possibility that aliens, not humans, would ultimately unearth our buried treasure. Without stopping to consider that extraterrestrial invaders might not understand English, we wrote a note to them. Unfortunately, neither of us has any memory of what we said in that letter 3 decades ago. Seeing as how we could barely write anything without the assistance of that special paper we used at school to make sure our letters lined up properly on the page, our message was undoubtedly short and sweet. Something along the lines of, "Dear aliens, please take care of Doc and enjoy the nabs. Love, Rhett and Link."
When our time capsule had been tightly secured with ample amounts of duct tape, we transported it to one of the many tobacco fields near Link's house. In retrospect, burying a time capsule in a field that is tilled and planted every year wasn't the brightest idea, but we never thought about that. All we knew was that the soil was soft, and we could count the rows of tobacco to remember the exact burial location. We deposited our cardboard time tube about 6 inches below the surface, made a mental note of how many tobacco rows deep we were, and proudly returned home.
The next day, our excitement grew as we pondered who might find our time capsule at some distant point in the future. Then it dawned on us that maybe we didn't have to wait for someone else to find it. Maybe we could just dig it up when we were old. But what if we died in a tandem skydiving accident as teenagers? Maybe we should just wait until next year. But what if we both experienced a sudden and unexpected regression in rudimentary mathematics, causing us to forget how to count rows of tobacco? You see where this is going. Shortly after our conversation, we went back out to the field, easily found the disturbed earth, and dug up our time capsule less than 24 hours after it was buried. Again, we were 6.
Thinking back, it makes sense that we retrieved the time capsule the next day. Not only because poor Doc would have been torn limb from limb and mixed thoroughly with nabs by the metal discs of a tobacco cultivator, but because our time capsule wasn't really about some point in the far future. It was about our particular now. Those silly items in that inadequate container buried in an ill-advised location said something about 6-year-old Rhett and Link. On one hand, they said that 6-year-old Rhett and Link were idiots when it came to proper time capsule construction and burial. But they also said that we wanted to take the time to mark a moment in our lives in a significant and original way.
Over the years, we've repeatedly tried to mark particular points in our lives so we could revisit those memories later, and we've expanded our efforts beyond traditional time capsules. Turns out there are a lot of different ways to encapsulate time that don't involve actually burying anything, but still preserve the memories. And it can be even more fun when you rope other people into it, like we did in college.
During our freshman year at NC State, we were roommates in room 24 of Syme Dorm. While many of our friends were putting flimsy futons in their dorm rooms, we opted for a more substantial piece of furniture with its own sense of history. At the local Salvation Army thrift store, we spotted an extra-long, 20-plus-year-old couch adorned with a hypnotizing floral pattern. We brought it home and christened it Mr. Fly. After setting Mr. Fly against our wall, we felt he needed some company. So just above him, we hung the fully unfurled inside cover of Lionel Richie's first solo album, featuring Lionel laying on what appears to be a gymnasium floor in white pants, striking the coolest lounging pose in the history of lounging poses. Then, in order to timestamp the moment, we each did our own Lionel lounging pose impersonation while lying on Mr. Fly, had the pictures developed, it was 1996, and posted them on the adjacent wall.
But we didn't stop there. We decided that each and every person who came into our dorm room would be required to imitate Lionel's pose and have their pictures taken as well. Eventually, our dorm room wall was lined with pictures of our friends and dorm mates, all of them doing their best Lionel poses with varying degrees of success. Hint, the key to the pose is in the hand and finger placement, as well as a head held perfectly perpendicular to the ground. We called our photo wall Project Lionel, and it didn't take long before random students began to show up from all over campus just to be a part of it.
When we look at those pictures from Project Lionel today, we see more than just the horrific hairstyles, questionable configurations of facial hair, and misguided fashion choices. We see the people who were in our lives at that pivotal time when we were experiencing our first taste of adult independence. Taking the time to turn the purchase of a sofa into an art project was worth it.
We have never regretted making the decision to pause and creatively document a moment in our lives, good or bad. I'm especially grateful that Rhett took the time to record the details of me breaking my pelvis while snowboarding when we were juniors in college. That winter, we drove up to Hawk's Nest Ski Resort in the mountains of North Carolina with some friends. That's about all I remember because I wiped out so hard that all the details between driving up the mountain and later sitting on a donut pillow back home have been lost.
Luckily, I remember all of the sensational details of Link's ordeal during that trip. I also remember thinking as it was happening that I must write the entire event down because it was so hilarious. I transcribed the events of our trip in a short story entitled The Tragedy. Here are some excerpts. The Jump. On our fifth and final run, Will and I cleared the tabletop jump and stopped short of the second one and waited for Link to come. Well, Link came all right, and it came with style. He, like a pro, bounced off the tabletop jump in full composure and landed it. It was at this point, when Link neither stopped nor slowed down, that I thought, man, Link's going for it. Link had told Greg earlier in the evening that he should go balls to the wall. He's a man true to his word. Charles, Link is known as Charles in formal circles, carved back and forth skillfully as he progressed to the steep jump. It was then that Will yelled out, Link, you're going to bust. Bust, it turned out, would be too gentle of a word. Link nailed the face of the beastly incline, was hurled 8 to 10 feet in the air, obviously lost control while in the air, and disappeared over the horizon. I don't recall what I thought at that point, but I remember Will following Link over the jump, much slower, and me doing the same. That's when I saw Link laid out about 40 feet from the jump, being consoled by Will. Will asked, Link, are you hurt? Link responded, my hip is hurt. Will suggested, take your board off and walk it off. I believe that no matter how badly one male is injured, if the first person on the scene is another male, the instructions for therapy will always be, walk it off. Signs of the concussion. Link said to me, I think I'm going to faint. He placed his head between his legs, then raised it, and I noticed a completely blank look on his face. He said, hold on, I'm just coming to. I was confused, for it appeared as if Link had been to for about 5 minutes. He followed this phrase with, hold on, I'm just coming to. I looked at Will. We both laughed. He was joking, right? Then he says, hold on, I'm just coming to. Evidently, I've hurt my left hip. After a few seconds in which Will and I questioned Link repeatedly to no avail, he said, hold on, I'm just coming to. Evidently, I've hurt my left hip. This broken record conversation continued for about 20 minutes. I asked Link who he was. He said, Link. I asked him who I was. He said, Rhett. He then became angry at our remedial interrogation. He was fully aware of his surroundings, but fully aware over and over again. He was continually forgetting anything and everything he or anyone else said. He was coming to repeatedly, and I was getting the biggest kick out of it. The hospital. Link saw that the nurses had put an IV in his left arm. He didn't like that too much, and he realized just how much he didn't like it about 5 times. He would look down and say, oh man, they put an IV in my arm. The conversation would progress a little, and then he'd say, oh man, they put an IV in my arm. I had a little fun at his expense. Before they wheeled him off for a CAT scan, I asked, hey Link, did they put an IV in your arm? Link said, I hope not. He then looked down and said, oh man, they put an IV in my arm. Later, Greg, Mark, Will, and I all went back to see Link. He was lying in the same bed, except this time he had in his hand a big yellow sign that read, Friday, January 8th, 1999. Charles Neal, fell snowboarding. You are in Watauga Medical Center. You have a concussion and a broken pelvis. As you can see, the key words that the doctor wanted to emphasize were fell, concussion, and broken pelvis. Makes sense. However, Link didn't take this note too seriously. When I arrived in the ER for the second time, Link held up the sign and said, hey, Rhett, I got a broken penis. He told us about his apparently malfunctioning penis a number of times. He was really amusing himself, and every time he would laugh, he would follow it with a moan because of his broken pelvis, not penis. He read the sign to me a couple of times. Then he got that I've just come into reality look on his face. I asked, how many times have you read that, Link? He said, once. After a day of relaxation and pain relief, Link was released like a restless coyote into the wild. His mind came back and he began to laugh with us about all that had happened. We took him home in the Dynasty just as we had taken him there. To this day, Link doesn't remember snowboarding that night at all. He probably never will. The important thing is that a few lucky individuals will never forget it, and I'm one of them.
It means a lot that Rhett wrote down the details of that night. Nothing says, I care about you, like a written reminder that you repeatedly made the old penis-pelvis joke with a hospital nurse. Of course, if this were to happen today, Rhett would probably just record the entire episode on his phone, post some of the funnier moments online, and then we'd end up selling a t-shirt that says, Hold on, I'm just coming to. Evidently, I've hurt my left hip. But I think there's something even more special about him going through the trouble of documenting my adventures in pelvis cracking.
Social media has given us the ability to catalog and share every significant moment of our lives. While we're both thankful that large portions of our years on Earth were not extensively documented, it is remarkable that most people born in this millennium will have the opportunity to share a virtual scrapbook of their entire existence with whomever they wish.
The ease with which we can archive ourselves online may make building a time capsule or writing a piece about your friend's pelvis injury seem less necessary. We have to admit, a Snapchat story featuring me lying in a hospital bed confusing my pelvis with my penis sounds incredible. But simply using existing social media tools to capture your life isn't exactly mythical, because it's not original. Everybody already does that. If you want to create a mythical record of an event, you'll take the time to remember something in a unique way. And by doing so, you'll likely have an even stronger and more significant memory each time you revisit it.
Note, we feel obligated to state that we are not publicly advocating scrapbooking. While we are well aware that scrapbooking might be a perfectly logical application of this chapter, we cannot in good conscience openly endorse the practice. So, we are taking a neutral stance. If you choose to scrapbook, we will not try to stop you. Just know that once you enter the world of scrapbooking, it can serve as an unexpected portal to becoming a cat lady.
We can, however, freely advocate building a time capsule. We also highly recommend Lionel Richie-themed photography projects. Since we already did the Lionel Richie album pose, may we suggest recreating Lionel's epic jumping on a pole for no apparent reason photo, found on the inside cover of his 1983 album, Can't Slow Down. This will require commandeering a stripper pole, and we can't help you there. Also, covering a friend's harrowing ordeal, with or without a broken pelvis, like you're some kind of embedded war journalist, is definitely a mythical idea.
Other options for historicizing an event include oil paintings, poems, ballads, commemorative tattoos, documentaries, and t-shirts, just to name a few. You'll notice a pattern. All of these options are relatively permanent. Less permanent historical markers, such as cakes, tree carvings, or shaving something into the side of your head, will fade with time and therefore are less mythical.
Whichever route you choose to commemorate your next significant life event, just remember to make it mythical and you won't ever forget it, even if you get a concussion.
The GMM Time Capsule.
In 2012, season 2 of Good Mythical Morning, we began one of our first fan mail projects. Using an old ammo box, we created the Mythical Time Capsule, filling it with notable mail items from various mythical beasts that we highlighted on the show every Thursday. Then, at the close of season 2 during our Mythical Christmas special, we carried it deep into the woods to bury it, where we found our friend and fellow YouTuber Julian Smith burying Santa. He offered to throw the time capsule in with Santa. As you might imagine, the burial was a bit fictionalized. Santa is real, but Julian Smith is not a murderer.
But we must now regretfully admit that the entire burial was fictionalized. We never buried it because we were told that the wooded area we visited was soon to be razed and turned into a park. So, we brought the mythical time capsule back home and buried it in our studio storage closet. We honestly always planned to bury it in actual dirt at some point in the future. We just haven't reached that point. The good news is that this allowed us to pull out all the contents and snap pictures of them for this book. The mythical beast sent us some weird stuff. Maybe we should actually bury it now? Here are the contents of the mythical time capsule.
1. Swedish meatballs recipe in Swedish from Felix K. 2. Cardboard box with Rhett's beard hair. 3. Tape recording from Leah P., Michael P., and Jesse P. 4. Twinkie from Caitlin. 5. Zebra finger puppet from Christina.
6. Kangaroo scrotum from Michaela. 7. Non-perishable bacon from Laurel. 8. Book, Rhett and Link in the End of the World, from Ruthie and Deborah. 9. Fake mustaches. 10. Little TARDIS from Sophia.
11. Duct tape bow ties from Aaron W. 12. Birthday card and recipe for cake from Lindsay S. 13. Possum skull from Hammond, Indiana. 14. Pentium 4 processor from Malcolm. 15. Fake blood from Rub Some Bacon On It music video.
16. An instructional manual for a drink dispenser. 17. Hot Wheels DeLorean from David F. 18. Logo necklace with Buies Creek soil from Tim. 19. Old pair of earbuds from Seth. 20. Carrot, cucumber, and cauliflower seeds from Crystal.
21. Pack of shredded dollar bills from Jesse E. 22. Squirrel tail from Drew. 23. Comic book Uncanny Avengers number 1 from Itai A. The Tacopotamus. 24. List of 2012 facts and statistics and 2012 timeline. 25. Good Mythical Morning optical illusion generator. And 26. Lock locker from Emily. A small piece of poster board with two pouches for a lock of each of our hair. Our golden friendiversary time capsule.
In 2005, a year before Queen Elizabeth's 80th birthday, one of her loyal subjects, an Australian man named Jim Frecklington, decided to build Her Majesty a special gift to mark the occasion. Specifically, Frecklington constructed a coach comprised of priceless artifacts from British history, including pieces of King Henry VIII's warship, the Mary Rose, wood from the door of 10 Downing Street, the headquarters of Her Majesty's government, decking from the royal yacht, and fragments from Sir Isaac Newton's apple tree. The coach took 9 years to build, which means Frecklington delivered the birthday present 8 years late, but we think it was worth the wait.
Watching a YouTube video of the Queen riding to Parliament in the Diamond Jubilee State Coach, we started brainstorming about what kind of vehicular time capsule we could build to commemorate our golden friendiversary in 2034. It may seem far away, but if we don't start planning now, we'll be late like Frecklington. We believe that we have conceptualized something that will adequately pay homage to the first 50 years of our friendship.
It includes the GMM desk with original microphone,
wheels from a 1991 Dodge Dynasty, Rhett's high school car, and a 1987 Nissan pickup, Link's high school car.
An extremely low to the ground original urinal from the Buies Creek Elementary School boys' bathroom.
An aquarium filled with water and fish from the Cape Fear River.
A wax figure of Merle Haggard with Merle's hits emitted from a speaker in its mouth.
A replica of Mr. Fly, our college dorm couch, retrofitted with a functioning engine.
A sidecar for Miss Locklear to ride in whenever she pleases.
A mobile featuring the contents of our first ever time capsule, Letter to Aliens, G.I. Joe Doc, and Pack of Nabs. Tattoo Time Capsule.
In recent years, young hipsters, amateur rebels, and artistic types have revived the ancient tradition of transforming oneself into a human time capsule by time-stamping moments and emotions from their lives onto their bodies with tattoos. However, unlike the more straightforward tribal tattoos of old, the meaning of hipster ink is often not apparent, leading to confusion or miscommunication.
While we are not here to argue for or against tattoos, we would like to offer a few words of caution, as many stampers fail to consider how their tats might be interpreted down the road and how that could affect their lives and legacies.
Let's say, for example, that 75 years from now, you catch a nasty strain of pneumonia that leaves you unable to communicate. Your favorite grandchildren, thankful that you are still alive, take it upon themselves to write your biography so that future generations can appreciate you as much as they do. Problem is, you can't tell your own life story, and your grandkids, bless their hearts, are too lazy to scroll through 80 years of selfies and status updates. So, they decide to simply tell your story through your tattoos. Uh-oh.
The following anatomical chart examines some popular tattoos in order to compare and contrast what you intended them to say versus how they will be interpreted in the future.
Wolf on neck. Intended message, I have incredible fight within me. Future perception, I learned most of my vocational skills while in a correctional facility.
Teardrop on face. Intended message, I'm in a gang. Future perception, I was in a gang.
Barcode on back of neck. Intended message, nobody controls me. Future perception, the robot overlords control me.
Ariana Grande song lyric on your chest, and boy got me walking side to side. Intended message, I'm hip. Future perception, I did not know what that song meant.
Barbed wire around left upper arm. Intended message, I'm tough. Future perception, I built cow fences for a living.
GMM cockatrice on right forearm. Intended message, I'm a mythical beast. Future perception, in my younger days, I had incredible taste in internet comedy.
Guns on pelvis, pointing at groin. Intended message, I have a dark, mysterious side. Future perception, I made a series of poor decisions in relationships.
Chinese characters on mid-back. Intended message, I am peaceful and thoughtful. Future perception, I once got a tattoo that said, I love corn dogs because I couldn't read Chinese.
Butterfly on lower back. Intended message, I'm free-spirited. Future perception, in the early 2000s, I was easily susceptible to trends.
Christy on right butt cheek. Intended message, I love my wife enough to get her name tattooed on my butt. Future message, I knew a video of me getting a tattoo of my wife's name on my butt would get a lot of views on YouTube.
Inner thigh stars. Intended message, I have big dreams. Future perception, none of my dreams came true.
Tube sock covering right foot and calf. Intended message, I have an ironic sense of humor. Future perception, the joke got old and I stopped wearing shorts.
Flowers on ankle. Intended message, I love nature. Future perception, my friends considered me flighty.
Chapter 5.
Embrace immaturity.
In middle school, we invented a game. We never named the game, mostly because it was never the kind of game we intended to tell anyone else about, much less recount at the beginning of a chapter of a book. Plus, it was difficult to come up with a name that captured its true magic.
The gameplay was simple. We would sit across from each other in my bedroom, no more than 6 feet apart, with our legs spread. We would then take a small Nerf basketball and roll it at each other's nuts. The only rule was, you can't protect your nuts. There was no point system. We just played until someone's nuts hurt too bad to continue.
It's worth noting that if we had never played this game, we would probably have much larger families. And while we love our children dearly, we don't want any more kids. So, in some ways, we're thankful for Nutball, or Balls to the Nuts, or The Great Nut Off. See, nothing really does it justice, for keeping our lives manageable.
I recall one particularly heated game of Nutpocalypse. That's not bad. I lived in a two-story home, and my room was directly above the living room, my father's sanctuary, where he enjoyed weekly episodes of Matlock, a classic lawyer crime drama we highly recommend for those of you aching to see a white-haired, sleuthing side of Andy Griffith. Anyhow, in the room above Matlock, our game was getting intense. After each increasingly forceful impact, the recipient would keel over in wincing pain, and the offending ball tosser would laugh loudly in gonad-busting triumph. As we sat there trying to come down from yet another laugh attack resulting from an accurately placed roll right to the groin, we heard it. Someone was ascending the stairs at a frantic pace. We got quiet and quickly crossed our legs so as not to be caught in the awkward position of dual leg spreadedness with your best friend. The door flung open to reveal my dad, wearing his comfort clothes, a V-neck undershirt, tighty-whities, and dress socks. He looked like a man who had been violently wrenched from a pivotal Matlock moment, just as old Ben was about to extract another confession from a bewildered defendant. Dad gritted his teeth and yelled, "What the hell are y'all doing up here?" Let's just say we didn't answer with, "We're throwing this Nerf ball at each other's nuts." Not that it would have mattered. Dad's mission was accomplished the moment we stared back at him in stunned-slash-scared silence. Quick as he came, Dad was back downstairs enjoying another predictable Matlock denouement. Spoiler alert, Matlock solved the case, and we started another round of testa-kill. I think that's it.
While we don't throw objects at each other's nether regions as much as we once did, it would be incorrect to assume that we have outgrown our penchant for sophomoric pursuits. A large portion of Good Mythical Morning consists of us doing things that might cause Rhett's dad to come upstairs and ask what the hell we're doing. It's not a sophisticated show. I once played the mouth trumpet while Rhett put a towel over his head and peed into a bag strapped to his leg.
We probably should be interrupted by my dad from time to time, but as it turns out, he thinks the stupid stuff we do is pretty funny. This is most often communicated via texts from my mom that say things like, "Your dad thought it was funny when you peed in the bag." One of the more ridiculous yet fulfilling things we've done, repeatedly, is bathing in substances other than water. It started with dust baths. After learning that some animal species regularly take them, we decided to try our own on the show. Our dust bath involved filling a baby pool with dirt and rolling around in it. While we didn't experience any of the purported benefits of bathing in soil, we did notice something else as we made mud hats for each other and created dirt angels by lying down and flapping our arms and legs. Pure joy. Months later, we followed our dirt baths by taking ice baths. It probably didn't hurt that we sang along to the Frozen theme song as we froze, or that Link found a rogue can of Sprite in his bath, but getting so cold that we needed to hold hands for emotional support was so invigoratingly stupid that it left us with incredible high. We followed up the ice baths with a ranch dressing bath, should have worn goggles, before planning what turned out to be the most significant bath of our lives thus far. Our giant cereal bath.
We had a 10-episode GMM miniseries called The Backup Plan, in which we searched for alternative careers to fall back on just in case entertainment doesn't work out. On one particular episode, we visited Organic Milling, a cereal manufacturer. This was an especially momentous trek for me, considering my lifelong love affair with the undisputed king of bold breakfast foods. Of course, we could have just visited the cereal factory, seen how they made it, sampled its sugary goodness, and gone on with our lives. But we didn't. Instead, we asked our crew to find an old hot tub on Craigslist and turn it into a giant cereal bowl. This is the kind of thing you ask for, expecting that someone will say it can't be done, but our crew proceeded to make a cereal bowl perfectly capable of accommodating two pajama-clad adult men. Then we asked Lupe, the VP of Organic Milling, to provide us with enough cereal and milk to fill our huge bowl. Surprisingly, she said yes. I get the feeling that this is the kind of thing Lupe had been wanting to see her entire cereal career. Lupe instructed her employees to haul out a 500-pound bag of cereal on a forklift. They proceeded to untie the bottom of the bag, bringing forth a landslide of cereal, a cereal inch, right into our laps. As the massive weight of the cereal began to lock our legs into place, I had one thought. I may be killed by cereal, and it'll be worth it. Then Lupe's guys came back with two 50-gallon drums full of milk on the forklift, pulled the plugs, and milk began to rain down on us. It was as if we had pierced the very floor of heaven itself.
Even though we stayed in the cereal bath until it became more of a mushy oatmeal bath, and we were only able to consume a small fraction of it, the leftovers were given to horses, no lie, it remains one of the most gratifying experiences we've ever had. It may seem unnecessary for two fully grown men to immerse themselves in cereal. That's because it is. But that doesn't mean that these kinds of pointless and childish acts should be reserved for children.
Children know something that we all too often set aside once we enter adulthood, that one of the best things in life is an experience designed to give you nothing more than glee. Of course, you can't spend all your time acting childish, or you'll end up living in your parents' basement until you're 40, sitting in the dark eating Cheetos your parents paid for, watching Game of Thrones using their HBO password. You don't want to be that person. But you also don't want to be an adult who never embraces immaturity, because you'll miss out on mythicality. 20 Ways to Embrace Immaturity, Checklist.
Wear your undies on the outside.
Check.
Drink from the dog dish.
Check.
Say, ya dig, at the end of all your sentences.
Check.
Walk like a cartoon character.
Check.
Repeat everything your friend says.
Check. Go on a Bigfoot hunt in your backyard.
Check.
Let a kindergartner plan your day.
Check.
Turn every meal into a smoothie.
Check.
Sing yourself to sleep.
Check.
Walk a balloon animal on a leash.
Check. Sustain a text conversation using only Disney quotes.
Check.
Buy a whoopee cushion and use it.
Check.
Have a serious conversation in a bounce house.
Check.
Go to school or work in a costume you made yourself.
Check.
Make people guess what you're thinking.
Check. Play hide and seek.
Check.
Kidnap your boss or teacher's coffee cup and write a ransom note.
Check.
Commit to an imaginary friend.
Check.
Cover your ears and make noises when someone says something you don't like.
Check.
Blame a fart on someone else.
Check.
Matlock Reloaded.
starring Reginald Vell Johnson and Jaleel White. Coming this fall to GMM TV, Sunday nights at 8 p.m.
Matlock, the TV show, ran for 9 seasons, 196 episodes, from 1986 to 1995. All across the country, tidy-whitey-wearing dads like Rhett tuned in every week to watch no-nonsense attorney Ben Matlock crack cases and expose the bad guys in the courtroom. The storylines were as predictable as Matlock's wardrobe, gray suit, and hard-working guys like Rhett's dad, trying to make their way in an ever-changing world, were able to rely on Matlock to dispense a weekly dose of good old common sense and justice.
Today, we're dads struggling to maintain the balance of work, marriage, and fathering kids from Generation Z. Yes, that's what they're calling them. It makes them sound like the last generation ever. We too could use someone like Ben Matlock to turn to each week. That's why we want to reboot the Matlock franchise for our time. We'd call it Matlock Reloaded.
Lead actor, Reginald Vell Johnson, known for his role as Carl Winslow in Family Matters. In the 50s, Andy Griffith was the perfect TV father who made his living in law enforcement. In the 90s, Carl Winslow was that same mix of lovable dad and principled cop. Like Andy, Reginald is perfectly primed for a new life as a crotchety case jockey 25 years later.
Premise. These days, nobody cares much for scripted courtroom drama, but there is still an appetite for reality TV courtroom shows, especially if there's a twist. For Matlock Reloaded, Judge Reginald deals exclusively with family matters. Is little Timmy seeking a divorce from his parents because they're limiting his screen time? Are siblings Lily and Billy fighting over their late father's priceless clove cigarette collection? Judge Reginald will swing his giant gavel of justice. It really is giant and inflatable to set things straight.
Sidekick. It's time to resurrect the career of Jaleel White in a big way. He's the bailiff who can't help but let out a snorting laugh at Judge Reginald's courtroom jokes. He also routinely drops important evidence as he's carrying it across the courtroom, giving him the perfect opportunity to say his catchphrase, "Did I do that?" America will love this.
Chapter 6.
Pick a Fight.
In early 2013, while filming episode 231 of Good Mythical Morning, entitled Killing Rhett's Beard, we spun the wheel of mythicality at the close of the episode, just as we had done 230 times before. Since the rule of the wheel was to follow whatever prompt it stopped on, we were obligated to fulfill the request when it landed on Slap Each Other.
It's worth mentioning that we had never, up to that point, actually physically fought each other. There had been close calls, especially when we were kids, such as the time Rhett picked up a fresh cow patty with a stick and threw it at me, hitting me squarely in the chest. And we definitely had our fair share of heated arguments, most often about creative decisions, including our impassioned exchange about who would be the rear end of the dope zebra. Thankfully, neither of us had to after we decided to put actual dancers in it. To be honest, neither of us has ever been much of a true fighter, even during our UFC phase in college, so we're not really inclined to come to blows. Sure, we occasionally hit each other for entertainment purposes, most notably the time that I shot Rhett at extremely close range with a powerful foam dart gun during our epic gun battle video, causing a nosebleed. But it was never personal, and it never escalated. When the wheel landed on the slap prompt that day, however, things would prove to be different.
After deciding that we should slap each other at the same time, I prepared myself to give and receive a slap simultaneously. However, I had reason to believe that Link would slap me harder than I would slap him. He always pushes things a little too far. This is the guy who ate a worm's anus in 11th grade biology class to impress a girl. The guy who lost control of his Nissan pickup truck while fishtailing on a dirt road just weeks after getting his license, leaving the truck sitting on its side in a ditch and us lying one on top of the other. Even with that mental preparation, I wasn't ready for the power of his slap. Maybe it was just an especially vulnerable time for me, considering I had just trimmed my very bushy beard, hence the episode title, but as soon as Link slapped me, just as I was slapping him, I was convinced he had struck me significantly harder. I immediately retaliated like some provoked, rabid coyote, slapping him again. He returned the favor, and I knew that we had just begun a real fight. A slap fight, yes, but a real fight. For a moment, I contemplated attempting to take him down like we were inside the UFC octagon, but I remembered that we were on camera, making a show, so I just let out an obviously fake laugh.
I admit I'm prone to getting a little carried away from time to time, but I don't think this was one of those instances. So, when Rhett slapped me a second time, I lost all perspective that we were on camera. For a second, I thought about balling up my fist and actually punching him in the face. But then I remember that not only does he outweigh me by 40 pounds, but Rhett receiving a black eye from me would probably have been difficult to explain to the mythical beasts. It also helped that I remembered that we weren't the only people in the small converted garage that was our studio. Jason Inman, our only employee for the first few seasons of GMM, was sitting behind the camera. He had witnessed a number of our arguments during his employment, so I doubt he was surprised. But it was the very first day of work for Stevie Levine, now the executive producer of Good Mythical Morning and all things Rhett and Link. She was sitting about 4 feet away from us, just off camera, watching her new bosses. She should probably tell it from her perspective.
You know how when you're first getting to know someone and there's this awkward tension whenever they do or say something unexpected? Your brain automatically puts everything through this polite filter, and you question if they were trying to be funny, in which case laughter was not only appropriate but welcomed, or serious, and you've just really screwed things up by laughing at the wrong time. Have you ever had that feeling, but this time you're watching two adult male comedians with wives and children who are now not just someone's but your new bosses, repeatedly slapping each other? Just me? Okay. At the time, I made the choice to not laugh and assume that this was not a comedic bit. I instead sat in awkward silence, wondering if a significant part of my job description was going to be breaking up fights between two man children. Thankfully, before I had to step in and defuse the situation, and after no more than 4 slaps each, they took care of that themselves by calming down and talking through it. They also stopped to acknowledge that this must be a weird first day for me, and promised that this was not a normal thing. I didn't necessarily believe them at the time, but several years have passed, and I have never seen them purposefully hurt each other again. Let me rephrase that. I've seen them slap each other with an eel and an octopus and shock each other repeatedly with a stun cane, but I have not seen them purposefully hurt each other out of anger. Either they no longer do it, or they do it on their own time.
It's impossible to work as closely as we have, for as long as we have, without having some arguments. But as time has passed, we've gotten better at resolving our disagreements by simply being honest with each other. In fact, our practice of talking things out has actually helped our friendship grow stronger through conflict.
If we had let things fester, we probably would have ended up slowly drifting apart, or eventually having an epic throwdown where someone got legitimately hurt. Of course, if we caught it on camera, we'd post it, because it would probably get a lot of views, especially if we called it Epic BFFF, Best Friend Forever Fight, Warning, Blood and Cursing.
You might think that with as much practice as we have in resolving conflict between us, we would be relatively good at handling it with other people. Unfortunately, that has not proven to be the case. The reality is we're pretty bad at it, in completely different ways.
While I've gotten to the place where I can calmly talk through issues I have with Rhett, I have a track record of not so calmly attempting to address conflict with strangers. I find myself in these situations more than I would like. A couple of years ago, a guy honked his horn at me when I nearly backed my minivan into his sedan at a gas station. When I heard his honk, I looked at him in the rearview camera that I had decidedly not been using up to that point, and saw him flailing his arms in a, "Why would you do that, you minivan-driving idiot?" kind of gesture. Feeling that his hand motions were excessive, I responded with my own gesture, not what you're thinking, but more of a, "I know that was a dumb thing to do and I feel sort of stupid, but you are making too big of a deal out of it, dude," hand sign. This resulted in the angry man suddenly swerving around my van and peeling out of the parking lot in anger. At that point, I could have let it go, and I should have. But I didn't. I reached down with everything I had, and although I'm fully aware that pressing harder on your car horn does nothing to increase its volume, I leaned into it with my full weight, letting out a 7-second honk to exert my gas station dominance. Truthfully, I thought he was long gone and probably missed hearing my horn altogether. Turns out he wasn't, and turns out he didn't. The now even angrier man popped a U-ey in the street and rocketed back into the parking lot. He got out of his car and bolted over to my wife Christy's passenger side window. So I pushed the button and rolled her window down. She was thinking clearly and said nothing. I was not thinking clearly and proceeded to give him a piece of my mind, along with unintentional physical access to my family. He didn't assault us, but he did unleash an F-bomb-laden tirade on me in front of my wife and children. After contributing several new words to my kids' vocabulary, he closed his profane soliloquy with, "One of these days, you're gonna get yours." Alrighty then. Actually, I have no interest in ever getting mine. I wasn't missing it. But what I did receive was the loud and clear message that I need to learn to choose to stay calm in the midst of conflict.
I found myself erring on the opposite end of the spectrum from Link. Instead of too easily getting drawn into needless conflicts because I can't keep my cool, I all too often avoid necessary confrontation. Because I'm a tall, slim guy, I have to get a lot of my clothes tailored to fit correctly. You may have noticed that there's a big and tall store, but have you ever seen just a tall store? No, you haven't, and that's a problem for me. I typically buy shirts that are long enough for my giraffish frame and then have them altered. After moving to a new area of Los Angeles a few years ago, I had to find a new tailor who could reliably reduce my shirts to the required size. I took 5 new shirts to a place I found on Yelp and went through the normal process of having them pinned to my liking. When I returned to get my shirts the next week, the tailor asked me if I wanted to try them on. This is where my tendency to avoid conflict went into full effect. I said, "No, I'm sure they're fine." Not only because I was in a hurry, but also because I didn't want to experience that awkward moment where I had to tell her if she had done a poor job. Instead, I went home and tried them on, or more accurately stated, tried to try them on. I have no idea what happened, but it was as if after I had left, she brought in a small boy and refit all my shirts for him. There was only one shirt that I was able to fully button, but I had to quickly remove it for fear of cutting off circulation to the lower half of my body. She had ruined my shirts. I was fully justified in pointing out her mistake and even demanding that she pay to replace my clothes, but I was still extremely hesitant to go back and tell her. So I waited a month. When I finally returned, the place was crowded. This was my worst fear. I had to confront her in front of an audience. She asked, "How can I help you?" I said, there's a little problem with my shirts." When I called it a little problem, I wasn't implying, as I should have been, that all my shirts had been tailored to fit little people. I was minimizing what was actually a big problem. She said, "Come and try them on and show me." My penchant for avoiding conflict was about to make things even worse. I walked into a small, curtained-off changing room, put on the one shirt I could still button, and walked out, hoping that she would simply look at me and see the error of her ways. But as I emerged from the changing area like a freshly stuffed sausage, I didn't see the tailor. Instead, I was greeted by what looked like a prison gang leader covered in tattoos, including a weird set of talons directly on top of his head. As soon as he saw me, he began yelling, "What are you doing back here, dude? My 14-year-old daughter is changing. Why are you invading her privacy?" I saw his eyes look me up and down, and he made a face that seemed to say, "This sick freak likes to wear children's clothes." I could have told him that the tailor had instructed me to come back there, that she was the reason I looked like I had just stepped out of a Gap Kids fitting room, but I didn't. I just said, "Oh, sorry," and walked back to the main area, defeated. The tailor eventually saw me in my boy clothes and knew something was wrong. She blamed it on the seamstress and told me to leave my shirts there so she could see what she could do with them. I don't know much about tailoring, but I was convinced that unless she had the ability to cast a spell that would turn a youth-sized shirt into one that could fit an adult man, I was never going to wear those clothes again. With no idea what to do, I left my shirts there and never went back. I like to think that they eventually found a home with some children in need.
We're convinced that there's a healthy balance between the ways that the two of us naturally approach discord, somewhere between releasing 7-second honks and sheepishly accepting tiny shirts. Sometimes being mythical means taking the risk of standing up for yourself or someone else, and sometimes it means choosing to rise above a middle school shouting match. This mythical medium of conflict resolution, a combination of confronting people when necessary while avoiding uncalled-for clashes, is something we're both striving for.
There's also a need for a similar balance in a mythical friendship. Sometimes friends need to fight, or at least argue, in order to maintain the open and honest communication that's key to a deep friendship. On the other hand, A friendship that consists of one meltdown after another isn't much of a friendship. If we could learn to fight the right fights in the right way, both with friends and strangers, there's no doubt the world would be a more mythical place.
We like to imagine a future in which no adult has to wear the suffocating clothing of Oompa Loompas, where car horns are used only in short, friendly bursts to greet other drivers, or to get someone to look up from Clash of Clans when the light turns green. This is a world where every time someone loses their cool on the highway and gives the one-finger salute, the recipient chooses not to return the favor by letting their own birdie fly, but instead keeps it in its cage and just smiles.
This is a world in which a restaurant patron who finds a curly hair in his mashed potatoes, when asked by the waiter, "How is everything?" doesn't just respond with a knee-jerk, "Good." No, in this mythical world, that restaurant goer would proudly point at the hair and say, "Actually, there's a pube in my potatoes." Even if he's wrong, he'll probably get a free potato. Creative confrontations.
Fistfights are so last century. Throwing hands never accomplishes anything except possibly making you go viral on worldstarhiphop.com. The following is a list of alternative confrontations you can feel free to use to settle differences, along with some signature moves you can unleash to achieve victory in each arena.
Confrontation number one, rap battle. Signature move, the rabbit reversal. In the movie 8 Mile, Eminem's character, B-Rabbit, disarms his adversaries by making fun of himself before launching his own verbal assault. Not only does the rabbit reversal cannibalize your opponent's best material, it also endears you to your audience.
Confrontation number two, Bake Off. Signature move, the Betty Crocker special. In the current era of gluten-free soy quinoa, folks often forget that the silver bullets of the baking arena are, and will always be, butter and sugar. Too much butter and sugar might shorten your life, but they will guarantee bake-off victory.
Confrontation number three, staring contest. Signature move, the Spirus. The key to winning a staring contest is to distract yourself from the taxing task of staring. Focus intently on breaking down the exact color combination that makes up your opponent's iris, the colorful part of the eye. Before you're able to figure it out, your challenger will blink.
Confrontation number four, a laser tag duel. Signature move, state the obvious. Once you and your foe are all decked out in laser tag gear, point out the fact that you both look like dorks and that this was a bad idea. The entire endeavor will quickly fizzle away at this point.
Confrontation number five, an almost real fight. Signature move, you don't want this. Sometimes you'll find yourself in a situation where your opponent is committed to a physical altercation. Say, "You don't want this." And then follow it up with, "No, you don't want this." Repeat that phrase again and again until onlookers get bored. When your enemy loses their audience, they just might lose their nerve.
Confrontation number six, try not to laugh contest. Signature move, fart. Your opponent will arm their defenses to deflect facial movements and sounds, leaving them defenseless against a well-timed toot.
Confrontation number seven, thumb war. Signature move, the fake timeout. This is a controversial move considered unsportsmanlike in most countries, but it is wildly effective. In the middle of your thumb war, say, "Timeout." Your opponent will let their guard down, at which point you will grab their thumb, pin it down, and remind them that there are no timeouts in thumb wars. This usually only works once.
Confrontation number eight, video game fight. Signature move, signature move. No, this is not a typo. The key to winning a video game fight, regardless of platform, is playing defense until you have a chance to launch a signature move. If that doesn't work, repeated leg sweeps are always an option, though you will rightfully be reprimanded for doing so.
Confrontation number nine, milk chug contest. Signature move, widen the portal. The key to winning a milk chug is widening both your throat as well as the hole in the carton. Giving your opponent expired milk doesn't hurt either.
And confrontation number 10, hug it out. Signature move, the creeper. Just because you've suggested that a hug is the best way to settle a score, it doesn't mean you can't still win. A couple of seconds into your hug, whisper something cryptic into your opponent's ear like, "I know what your pillow smells like." You'll seem like a hero to everyone watching, but your adversary will feel defeated. Chapter 7.
Eat something that scares you.
I recently rewatched the video of me eating pig anus with Rhett on the Willet Soup episode of GMM. I have to be honest. As I watched myself happily stick my finger through a cylindrical piece of penis, as I regretfully called it, and then later hum through it as though it were a kazoo, I thought to myself, man, I'm proud of that guy. My kids will watch this when they're my age and say, you know what? I'm the person I am today because of the man my dad was when he ate that pig anus.
I don't know if the adult versions of Link's kids will be proud or disturbed when they watch him play the penis flute, but what I do know is that we have eaten a lot of crazy stuff on GMM. We've consumed pig brains, spiders, live mealworms, gnats, leeches, cat food, duck tongue, cod milt, don't Google that, congealed pork blood, a fermented fertilized duck egg, fish eyes, clay, soap, suntan lotion, baby shampoo, dung beetles, pine needles, scorpions, the testicles of at least three animals. I say three because while we've definitely eaten guinea pig and bull testicles, we ate some insects whole, and I'm guessing some of them had some testicly parts, and more. Eating this questionable fare hasn't always ended well, especially for Link. After swallowing a whole Carolina Reaper, certified at the time to be the hottest pepper in the world, Link spent the rest of the day in the fetal position. He has gagged, dry-heaved, and vomited so many times while trying to get these seemingly inedible items down that a fan of the show made him a custom barf bucket. When I complained that I felt left out, somebody sent me my own bucket as well. Despite the pain and discomfort that our culinary adventures have brought upon us, we still believe that pushing our palates to the brink has added mythicality to our lives.
I was about the furthest thing from an adventurous eater when I was a kid. My mom fed me approximately 10 meals on a rotation. If it couldn't be made in a countertop electric skillet, it wasn't in the rotation. Several varieties of hamburger helper made up approximately 50% of the menu. I'm still amazed at how many ways hamburger can be helped. The other five meals were fried chicken tenders, chicken fried steak, stovetop stuffing stuffed chicken, beef stir fry, and my mom's pièce de résistance, fried bone-in pork chops. These pork chops were the only thing she was willing to serve to guests.
I remember those. I thought I was repeatedly winning some improbable dietary lottery, just happening to show up only on nights when Sue was making her famous pork chops.
Nope. You were just getting guest chops, along with mashed potatoes and garden peas, the vegetables my mom served exclusively alongside her proteins. Peas were the only green things I ate until I was an adult, with the exception of the short-lived Hi-C Ecto Cooler and apple-flavored Jolly Ranchers. One of the reasons I had a hard time enjoying new foods was my Nana's obsession with choking. My sweet and well-intentioned Nana would literally tell me to chew every bite 30 times in order to rid food of its nasty habit of plugging a windpipe. I took her advice to heart and to jaw. Whenever possible, I opted for soft, safe, fried meats and mushy vegetables. These foods were easy to swallow on their own, but I still pureed them in my mouth by counting exactly 30 crushing chomps for every bite. This was about survival. And thus, the combination of my mama's limited menu and my Nana's chewing regimen left me with little motivation to sample new foods.
I noticed Link's chewing habits from the early days of our friendship. He chewed a lot. He even chewed stuff that didn't require chewing. I swear I once saw him chewing chocolate milk. I'm legitimately convinced that he has done the chewing of 10 average men during his lifetime. And these aren't simple chews. These are intense, jaw-popping, room-reverberating mastications that have led me to believe that he's going to wear out his teeth like an old circus elephant on his seventh set of molars. Eventually, he'll just end up smacking away 30 times on every sip of his Ensure meal replacement shakes. I bring a completely different philosophy to food. I have some genetic quirk that gives me an impulse to fully consume each and every item on a plate in front of me. If you put an old, worn-out thrift store wallet next to a side of mac and cheese, I will find a way to get that wallet down. Not only that, but I eat with an inexplicable urgency, as if my plate could be taken from me at any moment. I promise I was never denied food as a child, and my parents never used a stopwatch at the dinner table. I've just always had a need to feed with speed. And chewing? Chewing is for losers. Once it's in my mouth, it's swallowing time. You could probably take the contents of my stomach after a meal and basically recreate the meal itself in its original form. I'm not saying it's good or healthy. It's just the way it is.
My approach to food has changed drastically since Rhett and I began working together. Over time, he has worn me down with incessant